I'm Brad Walker. I'm a physician, board certified in public health. Arma just kind of asked me to describe how I got involved in this. Well, this issue, we want to shut that one too, Arma, or leave it open?
Maybe we'll just leave that one open for now.
I've been involved in malnutrition and LDS children for about the last decade or so. Started when I went back to where I was a missionary, which was in Ecuador. That was in 1998 that the temple was dedicated, or 99 maybe. And some of the stake presidents told me they had a lot of malnourished kids and couldn't help them, so I was kind of surprised by that. I was a little skeptical, but we had a group of people take the height and weight of some children in a couple of stakes down in the Guayaquil, Ecuador area. And a doctor that was a member that I taught when I was a missionary in another stake up in the mountains, Guayaquil's on the coast, found a pretty good malnutrition rate in the LDS children. The slum stake was running about 80 to 85% of the kids were malnourished. The mountain stake was quite a bit less, I think around 25%, but both the stakes had quite a problem. So since then, I wrote up some articles about the subject that were published in Dialogue. Armand edited them for me. I got some responses. We started some malnutrition projects. Initially, they were in some projects in Ecuador. Right now, we're working with 7 stakes, 3 in Guatemala and 4 in Ecuador. And we're planning to move into a few more stakes over the summer. We have some people that want to sponsor some stakes. So there's a group of kids from BYU that are going down to take the kids' heights and weight and some of the other stakes. And there's a lot of stuff that happened between starting the projects and, I was naive enough at first to think I could get the fast offering system involved. I spent quite a bit of time trying to accomplish that. I wasn't successful. I mean, I did get a response back from somebody on the Quorum of the 12, but I just wasn't successful. Then as I did the presentation, other people said, well, you just didn't have enough connections. I mean, there's... Well, normally when I tell someone there's malnutrition in the LDS population, they just kind of say, well, you're either a scam artist or you don't know what you're talking about. I mean, that's the classic response that I'll get from people that are, you know, just regular members, is they, I don't know what I'm talking about. So there's kind of an educational component involved to it. But as I did presentations over the years, there were a couple more groups that tried to get the fast offering system involved up in Salt Lake. I guess I can't mention all the names, and everybody, one of them had a general authority in it. So they struck out. I mean, there's just kind of an ecclesiastical paralysis at this point with the fast offering system. There's people that want to eliminate malnutrition in LDS children. There's people that think it's a bad idea. So it's just paralyzed, and kind of just whatever, what anybody wants to do, they're welcome to do as far as eliminating malnutrition, but the church itself would have to have a vote of 15-0 to eliminate malnutrition or involve the fast offering system in LDS kids, and that vote is not there right now. So is that a fair summary, Armin?
Well, yeah, I'd like to suggest a couple of organizational things that get involved here. First of all, the way that, as Latter-day Saints probably all know, the way the fast offering system is set up, it's supposed to be stake by stake. And a given stake, or at the most an area, is responsible for raising its own fast offerings. And when awards fast offerings are exhausted from from expenditures, why then the stake is supposed to kick in. And if the stake is exhausted, then the area presidency is supposed to kick in. All of that envisions this kind of self-contained, stake-by-stake approach to fast offering, which is fine as long as every stake has at least enough prosperous people in it to keep the fast offering fund up for those that are less prosperous. But it makes no sense when the needy stakes are all in Latin America, and all the money is in North America. So that notion of trying to preserve the traditional organizational boundaries for the receipt and dispersal of fast offering funds is an organizational impediment that I don't think has ever been changed. Did you run into any disposition to change that?
Well, that was the initial goal when I first started working on this. Was like I just said, I was naive enough to think I could change it. But then other people followed me. I mean, completely separate groups from me said, "Oh, I can change that." And no, they couldn't change it either. They're just this fixed opposition to eliminating malnutrition among specific individuals in the leadership circles. That's not to say that that's the majority position. I don't think it is the majority position, but it can't. I would never talk about this in front of a normal group. Sometimes I give this an award or something. This is all kind of off the cuff right now. It's not part of the official presentation of the foundation. It's just.
But it doesn't sound like an opposition to eliminating malnutrition. It sounds like an opposition to revisiting the fiduciary infrastructure of the organization.
That's another way to put it.
Spiritually, I guess we're an international church, but then corporately, we're national.
The other organizational constraint is that you have a professional welfare bureaucracy in the church that has its own interests, and those interests don't necessarily coincide with what would be helpful for the ostensible clients outside of North America.
Welcome. Why doesn't everybody tell us their name? We're so small that I'd at least like to. I'm Brad Walker. I'm a public health physician. I've been working on malnutrition in LDS children for about the last decade. I've published a series of studies. I'm part of an organization, the Liahona Children's Foundation, whose goal is to eliminate malnutrition in LDS kids and their friends. We're trying to do a community outreach as well. Right now we're working in 7 states. We've got about 1,000 kids. Estimates are there's about 70,000 active malnourished LDS kids, so we've only gotten to about 1/70th of the amount. So this presentation, which I've given now to a couple, I've invited people from a couple of wards now, generally is a fundraising presentation, but we're kind of going more over the background of how the situation has occurred here. But as I was saying, normally we just kind of shoot straight into the problem and the presentation without doing the background, just because, if you're dealing with a ward population, they are going to be offended by me talking about the background, and it would drive them away. Hopefully that didn't prove my point.
She's in the wrong room.
And I guess if I'm going to continue on with the history, originally I had hoped to use, probably the most important point in fundraising is to be LDS friendly. You aren't going to raise any funds unless you're LDS friendly. So initially I tried to use an existing humanitarian foundation, but the people on that foundation had decided that based on a statement made by Dallin Oaks, they shouldn't eliminate malnutrition in LDS children. And they just refused to allow donations to go to malnourished kids.
What's the rationale for that?
Oh my goodness. Well, it's just Dallin Oaks' statement that somehow childhood nutrition makes people dependent. Now, obviously, the child can't work for their nutrition that they're getting. I mean, they're only 2 years old, so it's kind of a crazy idea, really. I kind of discuss it indirectly here during the presentation, but so they pulled back. On top of that, there were a number of issues with their spending. They spent probably $100,000 building a building, for example, down in Ecuador. And the church already has buildings. I mean, we don't need buildings. We didn't need to build a building. We didn't need to. So there were a lot of operational issues with their approach that didn't make a lot of sense. It was hard to get them to focus on the normal methods used to help LDS, to help malnourished kids, not LDS kids, just any malnourished kid or anybody living in a poor country that's poor. So,
is it just South America, or are there Eastern European states involved?
I don't think there's much malnutrition in Eastern Europe, and it's not all of Latin America. It's very small areas now of Latin America. And here, I'll start the presentation now. So it's called the Liahona Children's Foundation. So, Bob Reeves donated it to us. He had his own foundation. He changed the name. He donated to us, if you all know Bob Reeves. So we kind of took over his charitable foundation, renamed it. We have a tax attorney. We have a BYU professor that's on the board. We have a BYU Health Center pediatrician that's the acting CEO, and Bob is the vice president. I'm the chief operating officer. Since I'm the only person with the foundation right now who speaks Spanish, I try to run the projects. And then we have a couple of BYU kids that graduated now that are taking people down to Latin America and taking the kids' heights and weights at the stake centers.
You're not running into any church opposition for that?
No, the church isn't opposed to us doing something as long as we, you know, just don't criticize. That's all they care about. I think the current church president is a fan of this kind of a program. I think he is a fan of this kind of a program.
So, right.
So it's not that the church is opposed. As long as you don't criticize, there's no problem. That's why with that very first stuff we just said, I would never say in a different setting.
But some think your approach is inconsistent with their being self-reliant.
Yes, that's
the point.
That's the main point. I'll get to that a little later. So we have a lot of stake presidents in Guatemala or Ecuador that have asked us to come down and do their stake. We're reaching 2% of the kids. Now we're reaching between 1% and 2% of the kids. So there's plenty of opportunity here. This is the mission of the foundation: provide nutrient-dense supplements. In all poor countries, something is manufactured, usually by the government or a quasi-governmental organization that specifically is for malnourished kids. I didn't bring any here today. In Guatemala, it's called Inca Perina. In Ecuador, it's called Mi Papilla. And it's a powder that has all the protein and micronutrients that they need, plus a lot of calories. You mix it with some water and they drink it. And you can start using it up at age 6 months. As they get older and get into school, sometimes they turn it into a solid thing that looks like a cookie. It's not really good tasting. If I were to give it to you, you wouldn't like it. There's not a lot of diversion potential to adults from the product, which is one of the reasons they make it the way that they do. So that's the nutrient-dense supplement. You can just go buy it. In Ecuador right now, we're using a product called Vita Cereal, which is a soybean-based product. The product in Guatemala, as I said, is Inca Perina. The second goal is you deworm the kids every 6 months. You take a pill, it kills all your stomach worms. That allows you to keep your food instead of the worms eating it for you, especially the iron part of your food. And this will sound gross, but the kids will have the worms come out of them, and they'll argue over who gave birth to the biggest worm. So, just as... as kids will do.
That'll do something for fun.
Yeah. Okay, and the person running the program in each stake is a local church member who's recommended by the stake presidency. And that's our coordinadora. So they're responsible for getting buying the nutritional supplements, getting them to the kids, and doing the health education. Every coordinadora is a female. So in each stake, we're paying someone $80 a month, and they're trying to get these supplements out to between 50 to 300 kids. Now, some of these stakes are pretty far-flung. I mean, they have units way out in the stick. So it's not an easy task, first, to find out who's malnourished, and second, to get the stuff to them every week. So they really, you know, they have to really be ingenious almost sometimes to figure out how to best do it. And then we take their height and their weight every 6 months. We see how they're doing. We wanted to do elementary education scholarships. The number of kids that need some help to be able to go to elementary school is probably about 30,000 maybe, instead of the 75,000 malnourished, but we don't have enough funding right now to allow us to really do that. But the coordinators are interested in trying to get some of the kids into elementary school. This program is very similar to the programs run by the World Health Organization. These programs are all over the place. The only difference here is that we're emphasizing the LDS population, we're utilizing the LDS members, and we're utilizing the LDS physical facilities, the stake buildings. And we're trying to adopt one non-LDS kid for every LDS kid. We're not there. We're probably running about 90% members and about 10% non-members. And the other thing we don't want to do is duplicate state services. If the state's paying for the nutritional supplement, we don't want to duplicate that service. We would just get the stuff from the state. In Ecuador, that's a little bit of a... I mean, we aren't sure as an organization what to do, because the government is sponsoring about half the kids. There's about 1 million malnourished kids in Ecuador, so the government's sponsoring half of them. If we put our own kids on a government program, if we can get them on there, we'll kick another kid off. So anyway, that's kind of a... Guatemala hardly has anything going on, so their government just has barely started a program out in some of the very most rural communities. Now, these are the malnutrition numbers. The problem is pretty circumscribed into Central America, the Andean area of South America, and the Philippines. There's also a problem in Africa, but that's a very dispersed population, the LDS population in Africa. So that would be a completely separate project to try to get into Africa. Right now, we're just working in Latin America. There's a big need, though, in the Philippines. You can see that there's 18,000 kids affected in the Philippines. And within Latin America, Guatemala and Bolivia have by far the worst problem. They're up at 50% malnourished. Central America's next. Any questions on this slide?
It's hard to see.
None in Mexico?
What's that? Mexico eliminated its malnutrition problem. Their malnutrition rate's down to about 4%, as is Brazil's. So Mexico has kind of flipped the curve, and their problem right now is mostly childhood obesity, like in the United States. Not much of a problem in Mexico or Brazil, where a couple of million, you know, LDS population live, and where half of Latin America's population lives between those two countries. And so you're dealing with a country like Mexico that at one time had, you know, a malnutrition rate of 33%, but they've gotten rid of it. Their program worked. They run their own state program. So does Brazil. Just Guatemala and Bolivia are so poor, as is Ecuador and Peru, that they just haven't been able to get there yet. They're trying, though. The governments are trying.
Paraguay? I don't see Paraguay there.
You know, I didn't look up Paraguay. That's a good suggestion. Try to put Paraguay on here. I don't know what the problem. I heard Paraguay has a problem from a missionary I ran into.
Yeah, Uruguay, Argentina, Chile should be like Brazil. Shouldn't be much there.
Now, there's nothing on the southern cone countries. Colombia and Venezuela are doing fine. All of the Caribbean's fine now. Even Dominican Republic used to have a problem, but it doesn't really have a problem anymore, except Haiti, and Haiti still has a problem.
But Paraguay might.
Paraguay might have a problem. Yeah, it's not an Andean country. It's, I don't know how many states are in Paraguay, 3 or 4 maybe. What's the population of that country, 2 or 3 million? It's a small country, but it could have a problem. Okay, malnutrition programs. They prevent about 5% of the kids from just flat out dying. They avoid lifelong physical and cognitive stunting. IQs have risen around the world quite a bit, especially in developed countries over the last 50 years. But kids who don't get nutrition as a child have a lower IQ. They're also short and weak. It can be kind of interesting to see. You go up to a kid, say, how old are you? And they say they're 12, and they look like they're 6, and you'll say, gee. Well, that's why they just didn't get enough food. And of course, from a church standpoint, you'd like the kids not to grow up illiterate like is currently happening, so they can be in church leadership positions. The most recent study published in Lancet and Journal of the American Medical Association suggested nutritional supplementation will increase adult earnings by about 20%. Okay, to sponsor a child is $50 a year. That's about the cost of wiring the money, hiring the coordinator, getting the supplement to them, and monitoring them. Well, the entire stake, if they have 100 kids, would be about $5,000 a year. But we also pay the coordinator $80 a month. When I first started this project, we thought we could get the coordinators to volunteer, just do it strictly on a volunteer basis. I mean, everybody wants everything to be volunteer, but I found out pretty quick that just, you don't have somebody on the ground that's paid. It's chaos. It's complete chaos.
So it's one coordinator per how many kids?
Per stake. Yeah, selected or with the approval of the stake presidency. And it varies from stake to stake. I mean, the lowest stake we went to probably had about 70 to 80 malnourished kids. The highest ones are over 300, just depending on the area.
That person's probably bilingual.
Well, the coordinator's local. They don't speak English. I don't think we have one coordinator that can speak some English out of the seven of them so far. And then we did a Christmas party for them. They sent us back pictures of the Christmas party. I'd forgotten the Christmas in Latin America. They were out running around in their shorts. It was beautiful weather. So about 85% of our donations go to direct provision of services. And Bobbery said, that's not good enough. We have to say it's 100%. Well, all right, I can say 100% of your donations go to direct services, and all my donations will go to the cost of wiring the money plus paying the coordinator if you want me to. But you can't run a program without some cost. So I wanted to email Bob a statement from somebody, a church for the LDS Humanitarian Foundation that said, we have 0% expenses. 100% of your donations go to the project. I think, well, you've got all those employees up there, and I mean, that's just a shell game. You know, obviously you'd have the expenses. You can't run a project without expenses. So we aren't spending anything in the United States, though. No one in the United States has received any money. Everybody in the United States is a volunteer. Okay. Our fundraising. First, we're trying to inviting people to sponsor a child. Now, that question mark there is what kind of report given relates to the fact that when we went down to Guatemala and Ecuador, the area offices asked us not to put specific kids' pictures on the internet. And the reason for that was they're afraid someone would do something to them, so we aren't allowed to take a specific child with their name, ward, and stake and stick it on an internet site or show it here. Now, if you're sponsoring the child, we can send you the picture, but we can't put it on an internet site. So we haven't tried to get feedback directly on specific children. Rather, we're going to use example children. Advertising, we've put some ads in the Salt Lake Tribune, we've sent out emails, we've done a little social networking. This was the most successful year for fundraising since I've been doing the project. We got about $13,000 over the holidays and had about 50 donors. So that's a couple hundred per donor. It's pretty good. There's a lot of, what do they call that specialty, marketing? But the only way you can get someone to stay involved over the long term is have them meet the kids themselves. You know, they almost have to just fly them down there and say, here's a kid, say hi, and then fly them back. It's easy to say they'll stay involved if you just send them an ad every year, but human psychology says otherwise, that until somebody actually gets to meet the child, most people will not stay involved unless they get the chance to meet the kid. And hence, we came up with this idea of these Nutri tours, or if people want to go meet some of the kids, they can.
Could that meeting be virtual at all? Could you imagine doing a Skype phone call with this between the sponsor and the kid?
That's a good question. We hadn't even thought of that.
I can imagine that could be repeated every few months, so the kid would feel like they're trying to do something for prove themselves in some sense as well. It could be mutually reinforcing.
What we tried right now is just at the Christmas party, have the kid write a letter and then send. And we haven't even gotten the letters back yet because the people are going down here over the summer and are going to bring back the letters. But the Skype's an interesting idea. Most of the people we're using don't have internet at their house. I don't think anybody.
Sure, not at their home.
No, but they have to go somewhere.
Someplace you could do it. You could organize it, I imagine. Yeah.
And then this next statement, that donors should not only be concerned about fraud, but efficiency. Does anybody know what the concept of disability-adjusted life years are, DALYs? Every health intervention is rated by health economists on how much it costs to prevent a year of death. But they couldn't just call it a year of death, so they adjusted the year of death for disability, for what age the year happens at, and a number of other factors. They call those DALYs. In the U.S., the more qualies are used, something called quality-adjusted life years, but in less developed countries, DALYs are used. So if someone's donating money, for example, in this program, you could probably prevent a year of death for $100. Whereas if you go into cancer donations, some of them are it's $500,000 to prevent a year of death. Or a disability-adjusted life.
Basically, to keep somebody alive for one year than the other one.
So, I mean, I get all these questions from people, well, why is someone wasting my money? They never ask themselves, gee, how much good is my money doing? I mean, I could be saving a year of life, spend $50 and save a year of life. I'd take me $500,000 if I donated to the American Heart Association. But that question somehow never seems to come into the the equation when I talk to people, but so I throw it on here. What do you guys think of that approach? Is that a good point to make, or is it a bad point? You can criticize the presentation. It's only the third time I've done it. I need, like, to write some.
I'm trying to think.
So what does the actual acronym BALY
mean? Disability adjusted life year. It's how much you spend to prevent a year of someone from dying. But it's adjusted for the age at which the death occurs. For example, someone losing a year of life at age 78 is valued quite a bit less than someone losing a year of life at age 25. And it also states what your disability is, because living with a disability also can be compared to having died, depending on the disability.
Yeah. Just in terms of marketing, I would say to keep them alive for one more year rather than to keep them from dying for one more
okay.
year.
Okay.
Can't you just put it as a year of increased year of life expectancy?
Life expectancy, yeah.
Yeah, so I would say that's if you're presenting to a... Sorry.
Yeah.
And if you're presenting to a... pitching it to a group. So I would take off the bottom line, right? So I'd say, I'd certainly say the DALY is low. And then if people, you know, inquire, well, what is it for other ones? And so if you put a cancer up there, there's going to be 5%, 10%, 40% of the people in the room that have been personally touched by cancer. And they just might turn off immediately.
Yeah, that's good.
But if you wait for them to bring it up, then it won't be so offensive. So
it would be offensive.
Yeah, okay. So if they say, so what is it? I'd have the stats in your back pocket, but I wouldn't show them initially.
Yeah. Okay. These are other interventions that the kids need that we aren't providing. Acute medical care, that's predominantly what fast offering funds are spent on. Each stake, the poorest stakes only raise about $500 locally, but usually they kick in about another $2,500. So they've got about $3,000 for the whole stake, and most of that is either spent on acute medical care, or I know you're going to find this odd, but funerals take up quite a bit of it.
Where does the $2,500 come from?
The general fast offering fund.
Most
stakes will get kicked in about $2,500.
Out of Salt Lake?
Yeah.
Oh, well, so there is money coming down out of Salt Lake.
Yeah, a little bit. Not a lot, but a little bit. Not enough to run a nutrition program in most of these states. Shelter and clothing needs, that's the local fast offering system handles that okay. They don't even need outside money for that. Dental and vision programs, we're hoping to partner some with the LDS Dental Foundation. Vision's a little tougher. I don't think there's an LDS vision program. A lot of these kids could use some glasses. Then the microcredit programs, we have some LDS foundations that do that already. And do, I think, a very good job. So
yeah,
that's not an area we wanted to get into. And that's a program more that works with the adults. Our program's more for the children than the adults. This is the global malnutrition picture. 10 million deaths per year. About 50% of the deaths are from malnutrition. 50 million total deaths per year. So about 10% of the deaths globally are from malnutrition. 10% of malnourished children die. The other 90% suffer varying degrees of lifelong cognitive physical deficits. There's 300 malnourished children globally. That's up to age 12, depending on what you define as a child. You might read some statistics that say 150, but that's from ages 0 to 6. Then a couple of billion are micronutrient deficient. Amount needed to systematically eliminate malnutrition and elementary education globally is about $300 billion. This is about 2% of the U.S. GDP and about less than 1% of wealthy country GDP. 80% of these deaths are preventable with simple interventions such as food supplements and antibiotics. They say that 90% of medicine is oxygen, IV fluids, antibiotics, vaccines, and food supplements. So that's around the globe. And so here's the major causes of death that you'll see in a population. My initially published studies ran a series out of a couple of stakes on what the kids were dying from. And these were the regular causes that they were dying from, usually before age 1. Probably at least half of them before age 1, and then the rest of them up to about age 5. Once they get to 5, they're almost indestructible if they can just get enough to eat. So. There was an interesting thing in this book here. This is a book by Richard Stearns, who runs World Vision, the CEO of World Vision, which is the evangelical equivalent to what would be the LDS Humanitarian Foundation. He says the more statistics you show, the less people are likely to donate. They actually ran a study where All they did was just showed a picture. Like, if I were to get up here and just say, this is a malnourished LDS kid in Guatemala, please donate to help. That's when people would be most likely to donate. As soon as I start talking about how many there are and how many stakes and all this other stuff, people, their probability of donating starts to drop off significantly. So you're listening to this presentation, but I already know that if I say too much that...
I mean, that's an interesting phenomenon. I mean, just very, very autobiographically, I saw this write-up. I went, wait a minute, there's malnourished LDS kids? How can this be?
I mean, so you started at the same point.
It's like we take such good care of that level of problem here that, at least in my experience, that it's hard to imagine that anybody's allowed that to continue someplace else. And it ought to just be fixed. I mean, I don't need statistics. It's interesting.
Long-term effects of malnutrition. We talk about gross cognitive and physical stunting, poor school performance, reduced intellectual achievement, adult functional impairment. This is my sister. My sister's a pediatrician up at the BYU Student Health Center. This was her slide. She usually does this first part of the presentation. But of course, when the kids grow up stunted, then when they become adults, they don't make much money, so they can't buy their kids food, so their kids end up stunted. It is kind of a cyclic thing, unless someone breaks it at some point. Brain development. So, I mean, kids that are malnourished children, they just have small brains. Their brain does not grow.
That's mostly calories, protein, micronutrients, mostly calories, right?
Well, that's, I don't know the answer to that question. You know, my sister might know the answer to that one. Should we read these quotes? Are they worth even showing you guys?
It feels to me like you're saying the same thing over and over in a way. I mean, if you could find, I mean, this is once again the 0.1% or whatever it is you're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an important thing to hear once and have.
So maybe get rid of
the concept. Well, I don't know. Maybe this is better than the other ones. But I mean, my opinion, pick one powerful one. This is too many words.
Okay. For
somebody to read, but to have a couple bullet points and make a certain point really strongly rather than saying it over and over, just in terms of presentation, I think.
Okay.
I'm not an expert.
No, keep giving me your opinions here. So this was the initial study that I published with some other people about malnutrition and LDS children. The absolute numbers have increased just because we've converted a lot of people in the last decade in these countries. But about 75,000 active LDS kids are malnourished. And as we said, in the Andean region, Central America, and the Philippines. Okay. So some of the kids spend less than $100 a year, and we saw that down in Ecuador. That's their entire year. So that's about, 30 cents a day they're getting by on? Not much. And these are the country situations in the two countries we're working in. Ecuador's got about 1 million malnourished children. About 500,000 of them are in a government program. There's about 5,000 LDS kids. Guatemala's got 2 million malnourished kids. The government programs are much less effective. There's about 14,000 LDS kids in the 40 stakes. And the more you go out to the rural areas, the worse it gets. If you go into a stake, we've seen this in every single stake, the further you get away from the center of the stake, the worse the problem is. The further they live out in the sticks, the worse their nutritional status is. And this is a malnourished kid. Most people, when they think of a malnourished child, think of someone like this. This is only about 1 to 2% of malnourished kids. Why would this only be 1 to 2% of malnourished kids that you find as you screen?
They die.
Yeah. I mean, they just don't hang around very long. Once you get to this state, you're about to die. If someone doesn't improve your nutritional status, you'll be dead. And that'll be the end of it. So when you see the malnourished kids, most of them will look just small for their age. Sometimes you can see it in their hair, though. These kids are all malnourished. If you were to look at them, would you be able to tell that they were malnourished? Well, maybe you could. Maybe you couldn't.
Not the ones on the top right.
Yeah, they look pretty good. It's got good teeth.
Pretty happy.
could have been at an earlier age. Well, the kids are still happy. I mean, malnourished kids still smile and run around. They just
but don't. That's not our image.
Well, that's not an image, yeah, of what a malnourished kid would look like. So these kids are all malnourished. This was part of the data on the problem of, it's only from one state, we didn't get it in all the states, what percent of the kids aren't able to go to elementary school. But it's running around 7% or so aren't getting to elementary school. This is the entire screened population, not just the malnourished population. Here's a quote from a state president in Ecuador. Armin's familiar with this quote. Here's another state president.
Yeah, I think one of the most impressive and telling things that you reported back in your dialogue article was the number of kids who fall asleep in primary because they don't have enough to eat.
Yeah.
I mean, they go to church, they fall asleep. Now, a lot of us fall asleep in church for other reasons.
We've had too much to eat.
Yeah, but for those kids, they can't even get through primary because they don't have the nourishment.
That's that 3-hour block's a long time if you haven't had enough to eat. Kind of keep on going. So, here's some quotes. This is a quote from a state president in the San Felipe, Guatemala state that we got back. We've only been operating the seven stakes for, we're on our 15th month now, so it's a pretty new thing.
And he identifies himself as a Lamanite. That's interesting.
It is. Maybe sort of his PR way of saying, we're supposed to matter to you.
Right.
Something like that.
This Coordinador, this I think has been the most successful stake, the Momos Tenango stake. This is out in rural Guatemala. I think the main city where the stake's located may have a population of about 100,000, and then they got all these branches and wards way out in the sticks. We only screened, I think, about 100 kids that were malnourished out of those we screened. And they've gone and found a couple of hundred other kids. They've raised a lot of money locally. So they've increased the number that are being served to 300 kids. And we're only giving enough money to do 100 kids. So about 2/3 of the donations in the stake are coming from the local membership. We've only found, we've got seven stakes, and we've got about 1,000 kids, so 300 of the kids are in this stake. Very good coordinator. The former Stake Relief Society president, her husband was the former stake president.
So if you wanted, this is a silly question, but I come from a rich area. So you said about $5,000 to sponsor a stake.
Yeah, we have a couple of people that have decided to take on their own stake.
Right. I mean, I'm thinking of a stake taking on a stake or something like that. So how many stakes are we talking about where this sort of thing would be an issue? 5,000 times how many for all the stakes?
We've got 75,000 kids. It's about $50 to sponsor a kid. So if we were to try to get to every single child globally, it's between $3 and $4 million, quite a bit. I mean, our current budget's only 50,000. We're just trying to get, we're trying to go to the worst areas first. Right now we want to expand in Guatemala and start in Bolivia. That's the current goal, because those are the two worst countries.
So you're not addressing the Philippines yet at all?
We would address it if someone wanted to go there, down to some of those rural southern islands below Manila and start something. I mean, we'll go where anybody wants to take a stake on. And they don't have to work through us. If they want to do it themselves, I wouldn't say there's no learning curve to it. There is a learning curve. I mean, you can kind of get lost, like some of the other groups have, and spend your money on things that don't make any sense or forget what you're doing type of thing. So it is good to maybe work with a foundation that's already done it a few times so that you don't have to make the same mistakes. But any other humanitarian foundation can take on some of these stakes. It doesn't have to be us. It's the only ones doing it.
My stake president might be interested, so I'm wanting to get a sense of this.
Well, that was the end of my presentation, but I'll say it now. If you want me to come to your house, your church building, I'll come there. I live in Vegas, but I work in Southern Cal right now, so I'll be glad to come by. My sister would be glad to come by. She's the pediatrician. She's better at this, I think, than I am.
Where is she?
She's at the BYU Student Health Center.
Right, yes. Yeah. Well, I'm up in Northern, I'm in Palo Alto, so.
We'll come there. Yeah. You want us to.
I'll talk to my state president.
So you're envisioning it, your state president might be willing to urge this as a kind of a state project?
I'm imagining such a thing. Yeah, we've...
And this would
he's,
be...
He's a real humanitarian and a really good guy. And we've got, you know, Fortune 500 type people in my state. So right. I can't imagine that they wouldn't want to do something about things like this.
And so, you then, Brad, you help them pick out a stake in Guatemala or Ecuador?
Yeah, we really like, we're trying to get people to actually go with the BYU kids to the stake. Like I just talked about, unless you meet the kid, you won't stay involved. Although that's not always true. We have had some people like you that have stayed involved without ever meeting a kid. But I think it somehow kind of cements it. The BYU kids are going down a couple of weeks in August. They've already got some people tagging along that want to adopt a stake.
Well, but in one of those given stakes, there would be then about how many malnourished kids?
In a rural stake, there's probably, in Guatemala, there's probably about 300 to 400 kids in a rural stake.
Okay.
And so there's a lot.
So we're talking about $50 a year to keep them in nutrition?
50, yeah. So if we were going to completely sponsor the stake, we haven't tried to spend that much money on a stake yet, but it would be about $15,000 if it was that kind of a stake. Although, you see what happened in Momo's Ganango stake, where the local members took on a couple hundred kids. We're only taking on 100 of them. So.
Yeah, but see, a stake like yours in Palo Alto could raise $15,000 on a weekend. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, if our stake president asked them to, they could, it's the pocket change to these people. I don't know, you know, I don't want to overpromise, but it's the kind of thing that if people got interested, that these people, it's not a sacrifice to them at all.
I've had people that flew down twice now, two groups of people. They've always stayed involved. I mean, they just kind of took it on themselves. But in my experience with people who've never seen the area and met the stake presidency or met the coordinator, met the kids, is they kind of become thickly involved, and then they disappear. And this is also in this book, that for people to actually stay involved, they have to see it and touch it. They can't just imagine it or see a picture of it appear.
Yeah. So that's why we came up with this idea. I'm thinking about people who, I mean, I expect that what you're saying is generally true. I'm also thinking about people for whom time is, you know, immensely more precious a commodity than anything else, and to take time out to go down to Central America is probably not their top choice of way to, you know, and if there was another, if there was, that's why I'm thinking about
the Skype thing, yeah,
making the connection. If you can,
but I can envision a situation where a team of some two or three people in your
right.
state
comes back and reports, and
come back and report, and yeah. then become the impetus under the state president for continuing to push the program, and then others, as they feel they have the time, could go down, but. It would be tremendously important, I think, for somebody who's, to go down there and really see it and come back and give a kind of an emotional report of what they saw.
Yeah, this is the first seminar we've tried to bring along other people. There's a couple of former female missionaries that are arranging it. They've had a couple people that wanted to send their teenagers, they said, well, if you take my 14 or 15-year-old down there for a couple of weeks and let them see it, then I'll sponsor the stake for a few years. Like that. 14 or 15-year-olds. What am I going to do with 14 and 15-year-olds?
Yeah.
So they're kind of mixed up as to, I mean, they just have feelings that they're worried about the kids' safety, because these are, you know, you're going to the middle of nowhere, essentially. Right. It's just not like the United States. People think it's like taking a vacation somewhere in the U.S. It doesn't resemble that. It's a very difficult trip. It's a lot of car travel. A lot of hours. The kids are traveling. They wake up at 4 a.m. and drive from one stake to the next one with the bus driver they've hired. So it's a very exhausting trip to go on, to bounce around to the different stakes. This is from the Patsicia stake in Guatemala. Very rural stake, too. What do you think of these quotes? You like the state president quotes. Do you like these quotes? This is the first time I've ever used them.
You know, if I were you, I would highlight in bold a few phrases that you want people to pick out, because it takes a while to read a big quote.
Right. Maybe either shorten them or just highlight
them. Shorten or highlight phrases that are especially important for people to pick up. Or shorten them. I mean, they're great if you got the time to read them all.
Just one or two is all you need.
Yeah.
Here's one from the Santo Domingo stake. We'll skip that one. Here I have some quotes from general authorities. I didn't include Dallin Oaks' quote, which is kind of ant as the other side. I mean, you can just kind of get a general feel from these about that some of the people really feel like the current situation shouldn't exist. Not that I present it that way when I'm doing a talk. I just have people read the quote and move on. So. I think I've only done this twice with church groups, but these quotes were very popular. They really liked the quote, so.
Yeah, I mean, but you can stop after the fifth line with this one.
So shorten it, maybe.
How many people did you help? That's the point. You can fill in all the rest in your head.
Here's a quote from President Hinckley.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
We have nobody currently working with the foundation who has a marketing background, fundraising, marketing. We're just kind of flying by the seat of our pants here. We tried to find somebody that really knows how to do this, but it's easy to say, I'm a doctor, I can do fundraising. No, I can't. I will get to that quote later. Here's a quote from Joseph Orphan. Okay, here we go to the question and answer session, one of the parts of this. Why don't the bishops and stake presidents eliminate malnutrition and lack of elementary education using their fast offering funds? Two reasons. They don't know how to do it, and second, they don't have enough money. Even if they knew how to do it, it wouldn't matter. They just don't have enough cash. We discussed this question already, too, the idea that elementary education promotes self-reliance is somewhat obvious. I've never run into anybody who thought that elementary education didn't promote self-reliance, but I have run into people who did not understand the connection between malnutrition and self-reliance. They just didn't understand the concept of cognitive and physical stunting. So that, for many people, is a new idea. Most of the governments are trying to implement these kind of programs down here on the bottom. Some people estimate you'll get $10 out in taxes for every buck you put into these kind of programs, which is why they're so emphasized now by the governments, trying to get the earning potential of the population up.
Well, what I'm astonished about is that people like Elder Oaks would think that self-reliance is a relevant concept for people that are living below subsistence. And that's just...
It's a cultural thing. There's an entire quote I was going to read out of this book, The Hole in Our Gospel, that talks about it for the general U.S. population. It's not just us. It's
right. No,
it's a general concept that the problem of the world's poor is that they're lazy. And if you try to help them, you'll just make them more lazy. That's the general viewpoint. Summarized quickly.
That and the better to teach them to fish than to give them a fish, you know, that then they can continue to, you know, self-generating or, you know, self-perpetuating if you teach them to fish. I mean, that's, you know, there's a level at which that makes sense, but when you're talking about stunting and capacity, you know, it's a whole different game.
Yeah. Here's a quote from Food Nutrition Bulletin. Reynaldo Martorell, I think, was president of, I'm not exactly sure who he was president of. He's a well-known individual, though, with a World Health or PAHO. This was the UNICEF motto in Latin America a couple of years ago. most of the Latin American governments now are pretty successful. The malnutrition rate drops off markedly once the kids get into school, because you've got them in a place where you can give them all their nutritional supplement right there. You don't have to take it out to their house. So they're pretty successful in eliminating malnutrition in that age group. And if you don't get them some food, they can't learn at school. I mean, they don't learn anything just about. If you don't get them some calories, they can't do it.
And those come from the state typically?
Yeah, they usually are state schools where Miller's kids are going. So right now our program's dropped. We started out at age 12, then we dropped down to age 8, and really we're trying just to do up to school age, because right. The malnutrition rate drops off so significantly once they get into school. By then it's too late, though. I mean, they're stunning for the rest of their lives.
Yes, the first 5 years when you're developing, what did you say, 90% of your
brain capacity. Status. So it is too late, but at least it lets them learn whatever capacity they've got left.
But yeah,
so.
You want to take care of that first 5 years primarily.
And this, I had this question there twice too. I guess I'll go take out that other part. It's very similar to what's being run by all the NGOs, all the multilaterals, the organizations. This childhood sponsorship program. It's just the difference is we're emphasizing the LDS population and utilizing the LDS membership locally and utilizing the physical facilities. This is the program in Mexico that was so successful. It was initially called Progress. It's now called Oportunidades. But it really got rid of malnutrition in Mexico completely, almost. Maybe a little bit left down in Chiapas. So you give the government enough money, there wouldn't be a problem anymore.
Let's expand upon that.
I think that is a really relevant question. Is the reason that I'm so reluctant to give money to any outfit that I don't know.
There's so many good organizations, I mean, non-LDS-based organizations right. that are large and do a very good job. I like Oxfam the best myself, but Save the Children. If you're looking for seculars, World Vision does a great job. The Evangelical Catholic Relief Services, the Adventist, what's called the ADRA.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, and World Health Organizations itself or UNICEF are also pretty effective, efficient in terms of their spending. They just don't have that much money between all of them, I think, between the entire grouping might get $40 billion a year, just not enough to get the job done. But there's a lot of organizations that are ultra efficient, I think, in terms of what they do in developing countries. But if you give your money to a small organization like this one, you have to be pretty careful. If it's not a big group, you better know the people and kind of know if they know have any idea what they're doing, because there's all kinds of groups out there. First, there's the groups that are just flat out frauds that are just taking your money and spending
right.
it. And then there's the groups that'll spend it on whatever, and it just kind of diffuses into nothing because they will spend it on something that makes no sense. So you do have to be careful, I think, donating to smaller organizations. Having said that, hopefully you don't distrust us. This is the only follow-up data we've got published so far. I think we'll get more here over the summer. But the program was pretty effective when it was done in the Guayaquil stake. It's not being done there right now in that stake because it's a long story. I won't even try to tell you. But you can see that we got rid of almost all the cases. We got rid of all the severe cases of malnutrition, eliminated about whatever percent, probably 60-70% of the moderate malnutrition, and got rid of probably close to half of the, well, not quite half of the light malnutrition. Light malnutrition is still a pretty significant, I mean, the word light isn't associated with the fact that it's not a significant health condition. Malnutrition, you're below the third percentile. It's still, even though it's light malnutrition, it's between the third percentile and the the 0.5th percentile. It's a significant health issue for the affected kids. They are markedly affected in their school performance and in their growth. Here's a question we always got asked. We just made it into a question. Are children in poor countries smaller and shorter than children in the U.S.? No, they aren't. That's pretty easy to track. If you take, for example, children from Guatemala, who have moved to the United States and were born here from Guatemala parents, you will see their growth parameters are the exact same as U.S. kids. There's no difference at all. Pre-puberty, once you get to puberty, there's some difference based on your ethnicity or racial classification. Here's another question I almost invariably get asked, why not, you were the one that raised it, why not, you know, this teaching the fish idea?
We want to fix the spelling of the second word.
Oh, yes. That's the reason that microcredit's part of the package. It's not the entire package by itself. It's a great program. It's just not, I mean, it just doesn't get to most of the kids. Not everybody can go into business and become wealthy running a business in a poor country. The entire poor population can't start their own business. So people are selected that are felt to represent a good investment in terms of a loan, but it doesn't get to most of the kids. There's microcredit organizations all over Central America. There's still plenty of malnourished kids that need a more direct intervention than just hoping that microcredit gets to them. That's been one of the more frustrating things, I think, in working with the churches. They do have this idea that microcredit is the end-all of the whole thing. If you just get someone some microcredit, it'll eliminate the problem. Well, when it doesn't, then there's no monitoring, and nobody picks up on the fact that microcredit isn't doing it. It's doing something good, but it's not meant to be the entire package. Okay, now this is the way we're trying to approach this issue here. Why doesn't the church take care of the problem? First, I usually give the example that the church has had money stolen by governments. They've tried to donate in the past, for example, in Ecuador. And the government, this was about the year 2000, ran off with $500,000 of the donations and just stole it.
Oh, did?
This was when there was a guy in charge in Ecuador. I'm trying to remember the guy's name, but the government stole $500,000 in church donations. So first of all, there's concerns that their money will be stolen if they get involved directly trying to get money down to these countries. The second thing is they like to see a demonstration project first. And the example of that is the Perpetual Education Fund. That was run out of BYU for a decade by a guy named Woodworth. And a number of other faculty members before the church finally started the Perpetual Education Fund. People think that the church started that. They did not start it. It was started by somebody else. So the second thing is, sometimes if you get a good demonstration project, show that something works, can be done, its cost is reasonable, the church will adopt it. And in terms of the microcredit, which I say may prefer smaller organizations, the microcredit organizations, the church tried to do microcredit itself, and it just caused too many problems. You were loaning people money. When they couldn't pay the money back, they quit coming to church. So that's the start of the problem. They wouldn't say anything. They just disappear. So they tried it for a few years. This was in the Philippines, which was pretty poor in a number of areas. It was some of the poorest of the Philippines. So they gave up trying to be directly involved in microcredit and just said, we can't do this. Our project more resembles the Perpetual Education Fund, really, than a microcredit. We aren't loaning people anything. We're just telling them, your kid is malnourished. Give them this every day. More like giving them a vitamin to take. So I can't see that it would make anybody go inactive. The qualification's objective. You're either malnourished or you're not. You either need the nutritional supplement or you don't. There's nothing to really make you go inactive over it, like happened with the microcredit projects. But I'm pretty confident to say the church is not going to go back into the microcredit arena.
Well, Enterprise Mentors International is doing very well, as far as I can see.
Right, yeah. They're kind of the unofficial church organization. People don't have to go inactive because they've never interfaced with the church for their loan. So, but the current, I think the current policy, you're welcome to do anything if it promotes self-reliance. So, I have a blank slide. Now, I'll go to the question here. Tell me what you think of this quote. This is the first time I ever found it. This was a quote that I just barely found a few weeks ago. Put it on the screen.
Yeah. Yeah, that should definitely follow the previous slide.
Okay, so you like that quote in that spot. I have a blank slide there, but I'll get rid of it. Okay. Now this is another question. Do we have a special obligation towards the LDS poor? Why not donate to Oxfam or similar? Oops. I'm kind of laughing at myself here. I just... PowerPoint for me, don't... Never work together. So if someone were to ask you that question, why even bother to try to help the LDS poor? What would your answer be? Why shouldn't we just donate to Oxfam? Forget about the LDS population. I've been asked this question doing this very presentation.
Well,
does anybody here philosophically feel that we should help the LDS poor? As opposed to just...
Because the state presidents have asked for our help.
I have three reactions.
Okay.
Personally, I do donate to Oxfam. That is, you know, that's where I send my, because I trust them and I know the sorts of things they do. But I feel as an organization, as a church, as the kingdom of God, we are asked to create a certain kind of society among ourselves, that the Lord has charged us to create Zion, that there not be any poor among us. You know, that's true in the world generally, but it's especially true within this community of faith, and I don't like that term particularly in this context, but this, you know, heavenly community that we're supposed to be creating, that we need to take care of each other in a way that is different. But then my third reaction is, I feel there are people who will respond to this who don't care as much sort of generally out there as I do. They're not going to be giving to Oxfam.
No, but that's an interesting idea.
But as individuals, they might. The idea that there's poor Mormon kids who aren't getting enough food hits them where they live in a way that probably...
So how would you say that to an LDS audience that's not Sunstone?
How would I say which?
That third point you just made. How would I raise that issue without stepping on someone's toes? I'm just trying to...
I mean, I wouldn't... I mean, to me, I'm just thinking as a marketer, there's an untapped market, okay? These people will be susceptible to the idea that there are Mormon malnutrition, you know, kids suffering malnutrition in a way that generic kids doesn't matter to them as much, okay?
So I guess I could say release the humanitarian spirit in the LDS membership.
That's, yeah.
Would that be a good way to say the same point?
Release, tap, yeah.
Tap? Okay.
Release is probably better. Inspire might be even
Inspire.
Better.
Inspire.
Might be even better.
You can also tap into that whole, you know, pride thing about, you know, a lot of people in the church feel that when the church services get involved, like in Katrina, people love, anytime there's a natural disaster, it will take days before we start hearing the urban myths in the church halls about how, what heroes we were, because we searched down here and saved them. And people like to, so obviously I'm cynical, but I think people like to hear that and like to be part of it. So I think people want to help their own.
Well,
and I think people think that as LDS, we do a better job with people in helping them. And so we can do it more efficiently.
Well, do you have any suggestion, Armin, too?
I'd suggest an analogy. I think that we have a special obligation toward the LDS poor in the same sense that I'm not in a position to help all homeless people, but if somebody in my family was homeless, I'd pick that person out for help first.
Yeah.
I think it goes back to the kind of familial relationship that we are encouraged to maintain with everybody in the LDS community. It's a family type.
There's probably just a quote from the scriptures you can use, either the woman who lost her coin, the lost sheep, you know, having found your, wouldn't you search all day for the one lost sheep, I think.
Do any of you guys have a marketing background? No. We have no marketers here.
I'm actually a communications director.
Oh, well, that's pretty close.
Right. Sign him up.
I'm a computer scientist. It's not.
I'm not real great with the external.
I did this. Go ahead. I did this a few years ago and had like 30 people attend. So I photocopied a little ad and had a sign-up sheet, and I have some actual stuff out of the Global Burden of Disease database. If anybody wants to take it with them, but. we're such a small group today.
So your fourth point, or whatever it is, this is our populations. I'm not sure what...
Populations.
You probably want to fix that, but I wasn't sure what you're talking about exactly. And the last point is not about obligation. It's about capacity, right?
Yeah, that we have the capacity to help.
Yeah, because so that's different.
We've got the physical facility.
So that's a slightly different kind of point. Mm-hmm. But I was going to add a slightly different kind of point, which is that I think some of us might be motivated by the fact that this actually might be a powerful way of strengthening those stakes. You know, we're supposed to strengthen our stakes, or whatever it was. that's what, you know, and to help the kids growing up in those stakes to be smarter and to help the stake take care of their kids is an actual way of really strengthening the church. So that's an incentive rather than an obligation. But it probably appeals to people. It appeals to me. I'm not as tribal as those the people I'm talking about.
So this is that you can make a dramatic difference in the life of a single child or 100 children at stake for $50,000 to $6,000 per year. You could prevent five from dying over the first 12 years of their life, give them much improved lifelong cognition and physical capacity, help them go to elementary school, and allow them to earn dramatically more income as adults. I should have said something about church leadership on this last slide based on what you just told me. So it's already kind of long. What else to go? So what do we need? Well, as I just said, we've got a budget of about $40,000. There's seven people involved. Two of us are doctors. There's Bob Rees. There's Russ Franson, who's a tax attorney. He's done all our tax stuff, and he's... Then there's Ben Armand, who's been involved, although he doesn't like to claim it, but he has been.
Just a donor. I'm not involved in an organizational sense.
We've got about three or four BYU students that come along. They're going down to Guatemala and taking a group of future donors with them this summer. And then we've got 50 donors that just responded to an email or a little ad we stuck in the Salt Lake Tribune. So that's where we're at.
Susan Finlayson is not one of those four students, right? Susan
no.
So I know she went down and did some latrine digging in Guatemala anyway. She's comes from a family in my stake, and I just might be another person who's got a real connection down there that might be involved. I'm sure she's graduated by now, but she might be interested in connecting between a program like yours and her father was just made stake patriarch in my stake. So she might be a real somebody else I could connect with the leadership of the state. Yeah.
The main thing I would really like to have is somebody who's marketing would give it the time to say, okay, I'm going to contact all the Guatemala missions. I'm really going to take this on. I'll give them some. I've got money I can give them, but I don't know what I'm doing with it as far as marketing goes. I don't know how to best approach people, the LDS population. How do you get to them? How do you raise the issue without being offensive? How do you make it church friendly? I just don't really. My sister doesn't know what she's doing either, so we need to market.
There must be some marketing experts at BYU.
Yeah.
I put an ad in the Daily Herald and only got two responses, and they weren't friendly responses.
I've got several
friendly
friends.
Friendly ad. You can see the ad right here. There's nothing unfriendly about the ad. It's still.
I've got friends at the Stanford Business School, so I'll talk to them too.
See if anybody. Because we're just kind of wide open.
So I can help you with the immediate. So I think, shape it up a PowerPoint presentation so I can help you reframe this, starting from here's and make it much more concise. Here's the global perspective, here's the need and that we have in these countries. Here's what we're asking you. Here's how your donations actually help. And here's what we're asking for you. The Q&A, those you never even show those are just back pocket things that you address when people ask them. It's a 10-slide presentation. All right, so I can certainly help you with that, but you're looking for someone to provide the resources, the time and dedication needed to figure out the outreach program for different states and things like that. That's a little bit heavy. I'd be happy to consult and help people talk people through things. And
I feel like I might run into somebody, but this is for you. just throw it back in the mail to them.
Okay.
I haven't. Then we have a little how to donate thing, which is on our stuff here. We're doing the Nutri Tour this summer. You can go adopt your own steak if you want to. The Malnourished Kids in That Steak down in Guatemala. Thank you for coming. Sign-up sheet, flyer newsletters are available. Now, this has an entire other part of it that the BYU kids have done. When they went down to the stakes, there were hundreds of kids waiting at the stake centers to be screened. It was a true adventure for them. This is a map of Guatemala, Ecuador, and you can see how long the line was. One time they showed up and they had about 500 kids and they had to send some of them away just so they could, they went and bought them some food, told them to come back in a few hours. There were just too many at once. Took their height, took their weight, their birthday, their ward, their stake, their name. It's interesting, in Latin America, a lot of these places, they don't have an address. I mean, there is no address.
So have you tapped into the ex-missionaries from that went to those?
We haven't tried to yet.
That was one of the stake president's suggestions, and I think it's quite likely valuable.
My wife actually
has
been a mission in Ecuador.
I went to Ecuador on a mission. You gotta get into the missionary reunion scene. Every 6 months. There are even Facebook pages and stuff.
Someone suggested Facebook. Here's the stakes when they went to in Guatemala. I mean, our malnutrition rate, let's see, the relative risk. Once again, we're into statistics. Aren't the pictures more effective than the statistics?
I just thought seeing a couple hundred kids lined up to be screened to get food, that to me communicates way better than any table.
There on the left is the group of kids that went.
I'm a numbers guy, and I'd rather see a picture. I'm sure
I'm for something like this. You have ethos, pathos, and logos, and this is definitely an ethos, so it's tapping people's emotions.
That's you see a stake. So we have pictures, statistics from each stake, the exact number of kids being served in the stakes, and we've really got details. This is a very interesting little town, Otavalo. This is the last one we went to. It's way up high in the Andes. It must be up at about 15,000 feet. And it was one of the most successful missionary areas in Ecuador. But it had a couple of stakes, real high malnutrition rate. I think it was around about 40%. We didn't even get out into the rural areas. They just didn't have time to get there. And the people still wear the traditional clothing up there in the hills. Did you go to Otavalo?
No, I was in the southern
part of the country. And there's some malnourished kids from Otavalo that are church members. This is a city settled by slaves, Santo Domingo, a black city. It didn't have as much of a malnutrition project as a problem as I would have expected. So.
Yeah. So it's a matter of thinking through, so what are the challenges? Is the challenge that the population you're speaking to doesn't believe that there's actually now a malnutrition problem, in which case you do need the stats to support it? Or is it they're just unaware, as soon as you show them a picture, they're bought in? Or is it a matter of logistics and just figuring out, how do I get in front of these people? You know?
So it's I think all three things.
Yeah.
So I appreciate everybody coming. Any questions or anything? Thank you for attending. No matter how small we were, we were still here.
Well, maybe fruitful in any case.
Well, sign these people up.
Yeah.
Let me give you my card.
If you got a card, I'll take that. If you would like to be on the email list, and whatever other, if you would like us to...
Kim, I hope you're ready for students for your thing.
I hope I do, too. He and I are actually on extremely good terms, so... That cuts both ways. I don't want to push him on too over much, but he's a real humanitarian. He runs the boys' ranch in the summers, and he's a really good guy.
He's in a state that has a lot of money. Why? That